On a recent trip, I had a 2-hour layover in the Detroit airport. So I found a seat by the window in the waiting area and pulled out my book. Moments later, a young mother and her toddler sat down next to me. And when I looked up again, the little boy was staring intently at me. I must have satisfied his curiosity because he turned and walked to the window through which he could see baggage handlers and other airport personnel loading the plane parked at the ramp. What captured his attention was the small caravan of luggage carriers all hitched together next to the plane. He placed a pudgy finger on the window and, pointing below, said loudly, "Twuck." He then leaned over sideways as he continued looking at the luggage carriers and said, "Twuck," again. Finally, he bent over so far that he was almost upside down and viewed the scene from that vantage point. "Twuck," he said a third time with finality. From every angle, from every perspective he could manage, the luggage carriers remained for him precisely the same. He soon lost interest in the scene and returned to his mother. I come here today to share with you some of the things that I have learned in my ministerial education. But I must tell you at the outset that I have no absolute certainties to impart, as did my 2-year-old friend about his trucks, but rather impressions and ideas that I have gained over the past 7 years. Unlike the little boy, we all learned as children, as he will too, some of us with ease and others of us with varying degrees of difficulty, that when you change your perspective, you also change your view of the world. Ministerial education is not only about imparting knowledge, it is about changing one's perspective. That process is called ministerial formation. When a candidate for the ministry goes before the ministerial fellowship committee for oral exams at the end of the whole process, the committee is not only looking for breadth and depth of knowledge, the ministry is hoping to see and wanting to see a Unitarian Universalist minister. Yes, an inexperienced one, but a minister nonetheless. But once attained, ministerial formation does not stop. It's a lifelong process that will continue, and it will continue for me as I gain more experience. When I entered Andover Newton in 1998, someone cautioned me that theological school challenges all one's religious beliefs, certainties, and sometimes one's ministerial goals. Some say that the very foundations of one's theological assumptions are shaken, and that old buildings need to be torn down before new and better religious frameworks or structures can be built. I was assured that a good theological school is supposed to do this. Clear away all derelict or casually built belief systems and save only the most firmly grounded foundations. If this is the objective of a theological school, I believe that Unitarian Universalist seminary students have a great advantage in this tearing down, rebuilding process. Long ago, many of us Unitarian Universalists tore down old religious structures for ourselves, or have renovated parts of our belief systems in the light of new knowledge and understanding about the world and our place in it. We require a faith tradition that encourages refurbishing, repairing, and rebuilding as a healthy lifelong process. And the tools of our trade are intellectual, emotional, and spiritual inquiry and experience. Our goal is to build a religious framework that shapes our lives and inspires our actions over time. To experience a working construction site, albeit an internalized spiritual one, is to know that this vital rebuilding process is happening. No, I did not have to discard the old structures of my belief system. I had to deepen and also to enhance what I already had. So I would like to offer you three insights from this process of ministerial formation. And I will start with a question I most often ask. Why did I decide to go to theological school? Right off the bat, I will tell you that I can't answer that question. But I know when it began. It was 1991, and I sent away for catalogs from Andover Newton, Starr King, Meikle Lombard, and Harvard. I read all the catalogs eagerly when they arrived, and I quickly decided that I was nuts. I didn't have the right personality. I was not religious enough. I was not anything enough. And I threw away the catalogs. 6 years later, in 1997, I received a postcard from Andover Newton inviting me to an open house. They must have kept my name on some long-lost list of people who had requested catalogs years before. But I knew instinctively that I was in trouble, because the thought of ministry had never left my mind, much as I tried to ignore it, avoid it, and forget it. I went to the open house, and as I had guessed, I left with the admissions material. Within a month, I was accepted into their Master of Divinity program, and in January 1998, I began my first course. 2 years and 12 courses later, I transferred to Meadville Lombard, a Unitarian Universalist theological school in Chicago. And in June 2004, on a beautiful warm afternoon with David present, I graduated from Meadville Lombard. You have the right to assume that after 14 years of thinking about or being trained for the ministry, that I would be able to answer that fundamental question. But when David asked me in 1998 why I was taking a course at Andover Newton, my almost incoherent answer provoked his initial perplexity, which was quickly followed by incredulity and irritation. My children's reaction was somewhat different. When they found out I was taking courses at theological school, they looked at me very suspiciously, as though I was having a middle-aged identity crisis and might blow up at any minute. They were probably right. As I had no better answer over the ensuing months and years, they gave up in disgust and would respond with, "Whatever, Mom," if I brought up the subject of ministry. So here I am without a succinct answer, but I don't feel badly for two reasons. The first is that I didn't choose the ministry. I just gave up the battle of resisting the urge to go to seminary. This does happen, and it feels like an undertow to which one finally submits. You'll know if it's happening to you. Secondly, I know a minister older, more experienced, and far wiser than me who confessed that he had never been able to answer that question for himself. So I am in good company. What can I say? Only this, that it feels right to me, and I never considered stopping the process. A second insight that I have about the ministry is that it is the hardest work that I will ever do. I have always held clergy to a very, very high standard of behavior, and Steve Eddington and Don Rowley have modeled that level of personal and professional excellence. Gee, fellows. Thanks for setting the bar so high. I know that I will be challenged in many ways, and I'm sure there will be times when I just want to kick back, indulge myself, and not hold myself accountable. But as my academic advisor reminded me at my ordination, being a minister does not wash off, nor can one take it off as one would a ministerial robe or stole and hang it in the closet. One is changed forever. Now, don't get the idea that ministry makes me or anyone else into a goody-two-shoes, or that all ministers are alike. No two of us are the same, and we each carry our own personal knapsacks full of skills, talents, faults, and vulnerabilities. However, conscientious members of our clergy share at least two characteristics. That is, we strive for ethical intentionality by living the principles of Unitarian Universalism and by giving the very best of ourselves to the people we serve. The moment a member of the clergy acts in a way that is not congruent with his or her stated beliefs is the moment that parishioners and others lose trust in that person. While other professionals in law or medicine can be judged on the merits of their knowledge and technical skills alone, clergy are judged more broadly, not only on knowledge and skills, but on every aspect of their personality, behavior, and lifestyle. This requires that we reflect on our behaviors, opinions, and words before we act to make sure that they are consistent with our principles and that we try to do what we think is right, even if right action is difficult, unpopular, or challenging. But even in my short time in the ministry, I have experienced something more than just hard work. It's another important perspective that I call a sense of joyfulness. I have been more intellectually, interpersonally, and spiritually happy in this field than in any previous endeavor. I discovered this joyfulness in my parish work during my internship and in my hospice chaplaincy praxis in Manchester, New Hampshire. In his presenting the right-handed fellowship at my ordination, Steve said, "Ministry has brought a wonderful and blessed dimension to my life that I am sure I would not have otherwise known." I know that that's going to be true for me as well. A third insight I have about ordained ministry is that no one does it alone. Ministry as a profession is relational, and it occurs in the church, the religious classroom, religious education classroom, or in the community. It is a ministry of both laity and ordained clergy. I know from my internship that the members of the congregation help to create who I am as a minister. I only hope that my gift to them was as great. During my 7 years of education, I have been helped and supported by many others. Family, friends, classmates, colleagues, teachers, and even strangers. For example, in 1998, I was in an auto accident and was not able to drive to Andover Newton because of a broken wrist. David drove me to class the first week, and after class, a young woman, a classmate who I did not know, volunteered to drive me in the future. For the remainder of the term, she left her home in Manchester, New Hampshire, very early so that she could pick me up in Nashua and drive me to my 9 o'clock class. Without her help and David's, I never would have completed my first course. As a second example, in November 2004, I asked Unitarian Universalist clergy in New Hampshire if they would help prepare me for my interview with the ministerial fellow. hardworking ministers, some who I did not know, gave up half a day to coach me through the interview process. But there's another perspective. There's always another perspective that is also true. It is the reality that ultimately one is alone in ministry. A spiritual quest is always a solitary affair, and a minister must be alone in thought before words are spoken, alone in intention before action is taken, and alone in emotion before it finds expression. It must be this way in order for the person to be responsible and accountable in both word and deed. The final impression I want to share with you is also intangible. It is to trust the process itself. My trust continues, and I believe that my ministerial life and employment will someday emerge, although I don't know exactly what it's going to be. No, I don't have a community placement awaiting me in New Hampshire, but I didn't have one in Florida either until a conversation with an acquaintance produced a paid position at Planned Parenthood. Something like that will happen again, because this is not the first time I have had unexplained and unexplainable opportunities. Why, for example, did Andover Newton send me an invitation 6 years after my first contact? And how did they know to wait that long until the time was right for me to say yes? Why did I telephone Meadville Lombard out of the blue on April 30th, 1999? In that conversation, the dean of students, who happened to be at his desk, and the man spends no time in his office, but he was there that day, the dean of students told me that the school had just approved that week a new community ministry program, that there was one opening, and that registration closed on May 1st, which was the next day. I said to him, I want that spot. Pretty brazen. And then I came home and told David what I had done. That could not happen today, because that new program is so popular that it has a long waiting list. Was this luck? Was this serendipity? These unexplained opportunities are called by a friend of mine, grace, and by a Muslim acquaintance, the breath of God on one's face. I'll settle for mystery, but I realized that ministry is much more than intellect. It has a healthy measure of intuition, emotion, and luck. I have shared with you insights that I've gained along my path to ordained ministry, but I must digress for a moment to relate a point of our history. In the earliest days of Unitarianism in this country, men who chose the ministry came out of their congregations, went off to Harvard to be trained, and came back to their home congregations to minister. This is the church that I came from, and these are the men who have been my models. And so, in a sense, I am a parishioner as well as a minister. As I have been talking, you may have felt that much of what I have to say sounds familiar to you, and very much like your own religious insights. That is because the path of spiritual searching, exploration, and experimentation is the same path that all Unitarian Universalists walk, whether we are clergy or congregants. While ordained ministry is a particular goal, the means that each of us uses to fulfill our highest potential within the context of our religious faith is the same. clergy and laity have different perspectives, but we journey together in relationship and we co-create ministry. So I returned to that toddler in the Detroit airport. He got it wrong. Different angles of observation change one's perspective. In very fundamental ways, he also got it right. No matter how he looked at the trucks, the essence of what he saw remained the same. May we recognize and celebrate the essence, the essential qualities of our Unitarian Universalist faith that exist for us all, whatever the angle of observation. Amen.
Thank you for very wonderful, affecting, inspiring words. As I said earlier, we'll invite you to come to our reception afterwards. You can greet Lee and Don there. I'm adding that to the, after opposing him, closing words, he'll join me in the foyer so we can greet you on the way into the to the dining room as well. Please come and be a part of this. It's been a wonderful occasion already, and help us extend that a little further by joining with Lee and Don at our coffee hour after.